Very kind. Thanks very much indeed. Well, welcome back, everybody. I expect you're probably a bit exhausted at this stage, but happily, the good wine comes last, both counts. Not that the other wine has been excellent as well, but this is particularly good wine. Our question still is, of course, are small open economies still the model? I don't know, Sean, have you talked through what if they're not? Are we in real trouble, aren't we? I don't know what we're going to say then, if that's the case. But anyway, like, we'll kick off, and I think Niamh is going to speak first of all for about 50 minutes, and then David after that, and then we'll have a general chat, if that's the way. And it's more a discursive rather than presentations. So thanks very much, Niamh.
Thanks, David. Yeah, because Sean asked us to respond to what we've been hearing as opposed to make any formal presentations. And it has been so enjoyable. There's so many interesting things have come up. I've been struggling to try to group them into any sort of coherent shape. But I think there are three themes I think I'd like to mention that have particularly occurred to me as really worthwhile areas of investigation or things that will certainly provide food for thought for me. So the first one is about the case selection and the implicit assumptions about the models that we're using. And the two core theoretical strands that have been very central to, I know Sean's project, have been the model of varieties of capitalism and also the wealth of literature around the idea of small open economies. And what we're finding as we push these and test them and see leveraging Ireland and Denmark against each other as case studies in two different worlds of varieties of capitalism is that they don't really hold up very well. And yet they still are worthwhile. It's still worthwhile talking about them. They still do capture important or systematic differences. And there is something about smallness that makes a difference, but it's the variability that is I think has come out so strikingly today that we are at pains really to try to classify. And I was just thinking this with Darius's presentation, where even in the Nordic model turns out to collapse on scrutiny. There's no recipe, let's say. So is it still the model of what? You know, we used to have an assumption that there was something about small open economies that would make them resilient, adaptive, and that there was something about particularly the Nordic aspect of it. I know it's something that has always been of great interest to you, David, that is conducive to a politics of shared or inclusive growth around social democratic grounds. But how and why? And when we start drilling into it, we do find that that the categorizations are much more complex in the real world. And this is something that is very central to work that I'm doing with some colleagues, where we're looking at Ireland, Spain, Greece and Portugal in their long journey from the European periphery in the context of European integration towards attempts at convergence, and of course their major, you know, derailment during the financial crisis and differentiated patterns of recovery since then. And we chose them because they were the periphery four, because they were the cohesion four, and also because they were the pigs at the eye of the crisis. So they're, you know, one of the defences that we've had to mount all along is, well, they're very different varieties of capitalism. Why are you even trying to group them together? And our argument is that varieties of capitalism is helpful for illuminating some sorts of coordinating problems, some sorts of organisational aspects.
I'm very happy to go outside while you talk about them.
Well, I know you're not a chauvinist, VOC. VOC chauvinist. So I know this is nothing you haven't heard before, that this is not, you're not the Pope. No heresy can be tolerated in your presence. So, you know, we're not saying that these aren't still very important. But it leads me to my two other points, which is that at any one moment, there are a lot of comparisons that we can draw in a static basis. But when we look diachronically, that's when things really start to get complicated. So the second point I want to make is about how we try to think about what causes these different configurations. And we've had some really interesting contributions around nationalism and the evolution of states and nations in conjunction with each other, especially from Joe and from John, which you missed, David. So you can go out of the room now, because you don't know anything about this. And one thing that I think is problematic, and for me I'm going to need to think about some more, is the relative causal weight that we give to these two dimensions of social organisation and political organisation. I know a simplified form, it's not the only thing that they say. I know that John and John Hall have given us a story today about national solidarity as a big causal factor. And this is a kind of at the heart of our methodological issues in political science or political economy. How do we weight, relatively speaking, the role of ideas and of perceptions relative to institutions and the material conditions in which they are embedded? And I sympathise a lot with the ideational explanation, but I tend to be rather less interested in using it myself as the key explanatory variable, because I think that the kind of configurations of nationalism and of interests are embedded in a whole institutional apparatus, and we were just talking about this over lunch, and I know that John agrees, that institutions are not easily malleable in the short to medium term, that they do have a very long durée to them, and that where there may be sudden interjections, there may be critical junctures where institutional patterns get remade or get deliberately, strategically reconstituted. These are very rare, and it's very rare to be able to do them in a really fundamental way. And I don't know enough about Denmark to know how much of it really was a kind of material reconfiguration perforce, on the basis of military conquest and the absolute delegitimation of monarchy and the aristocratic order, which had led to this whole militaristic jolly. They won in 1858 or something, isn't that right? Is that right or something? And then 1864, George just went well. So the institutional frameworks. Joe was telling us this morning about the ways in which Irish nationalism emerged to create this multifaceted peripheral country that is looking in these different directions. And I think that's really useful, because I think that to think about the vulnerability and the resilience of institutions is, we probably have to unpack a bit more analytical concepts and constructs about the capacity of states. And thick and thin and barbarian and patrimonial and networks are some of the vocabulary that we need to use in doing this. I think this is very helpful. But for me, there's a bigger story about the institutions of the state. I'm going to have to wash my mouth out with soap once I say the word post-colonialism. It's not a word that easily passes my lips, but. And I'm rather sceptical of a lot of the theorising that would put Ireland in the same post-colonial package as, for example, African states. Ireland is in a very different position. We've inherited, we're the inheritors of essentially British state structure, and it is an advanced industrial society on all those sort of key measures. But there are some, over the long period of time, if we look at some of the key indicators of state capacity, The institutional ability to generate taxation is very weak, and it goes back a very long way. And there's really interesting work being done by Michelle Darcy in Trinity, for example, and Rina Nitsoskaya in Gothenburg, in the Quality Government Institute in Gothenburg, where they're actually tracking state capacity through a database of the creation of cadastral maps, in other words, maps of land registry, of land holdings, over time, to see what states can seize, like seeing like a state, like James, what's his name? James? Scott, thank you. What do states need to see? They need to see what the wealth of the country is in order to be able to do a whole extractive job. So the state, they've got the capacity to tax is a very fundamental aspect of the institutional apparatus of the state. So also are some of the other things that we're hearing about this morning. But I want to do some more work on this myself. Like, what is it about the institutions of the state that lead them to be able to work in a networked way, that lead them to be able to manage particularly the capital, the management of capital effectively, to manage inflows of capital, to be able to direct productive investment effectively, to be able to manage surges in good times as well as fiscal corrections in the bad times. Clearly, Ireland is really weakly, has very weak capabilities in these areas. And Denmark's are better developed. So what is that about? Where does that come from? And I think that some of the work that we were hearing presented this morning from Michelle and Mick, as well as Sean's more general reflections, I think are very helpful here, where we think about the actual material context of the formation of the state itself. So as Sean was telling us, the context of the land settlements in Ireland created a deeply conservative small landholder class that became the dominant political base of the post-independence elites of all sorts. The accident, we might say, or the accident waiting to happen of partition created a society that is unable to express its very real and very deep class differences in political terms, because the moment of mobilisation into politics happened just when nationalism was taking the centre ground and where the industrial heartland of the country in the northeast was unavailable for political mobilisation, in any case largely pre-captured by unionism, by those nationalist discourses in another vein. So the material embeddedness of state institutions in the economic, you know, what happened in the economic settlements and the economic evolution and the sort of the pathway to economic modernity, you know, we might say these it seems to me, are really important, and they give us the framework for understanding those nuances around the sort of the big typologies of rises of capitalism that let us find those niches. You know, why Ireland is not purely a liberal market economy, why it has odd sorts of coordinating capacities, and yet it's very highly externally oriented. And part of this, the second part of my second point, is also about the actual geo-economic location of states. You know, Ireland had the, you know, fortune or misfortune to be, as I said, the inheritor of British state institutions, but also to be directly exposed to the British market as the principal export market, and to be tied to essentially British rates of growth for a long period of time, while continental Europe was growing much more rapidly. And this is why I think the European project has come as a, you know, very largely nationally welcomed model, because it was our way of breaking not just national identity issues and over-reliance on Britain, but also to achieve that catch-up opportunity. Whereas Denmark is not just a small open economy. For a start, it was an imperial state, you know, as we've heard. It had an army and therefore an incentive to generate, you know, cadastral maps and generate excellent state-building capacity. And it also was part of not just a nation of 4.5 or 5 million, whatever they are, 5.5 million. It was actually part of kind of 22 million regional federal state. You know, people often talk about Scandinavia, broadly speaking. So the Scandinavian, you know, linkages, it seems to me, created a whole hinterland for Denmark that made it, that gave it these broader markets, this broader upholstery for its political endeavours. And then more recently, we have to recognise that Denmark, you know, for all that the whole Schleswig-Holstein thing is still probably embedded, branded in every Dane's heart, I don't know if it is or not, it's actually a part of Greater Germany is that an awful thing to say to a Dane? I'm sorry, I'll take that back. It's been deeply connected to the German economy for a long time, in the sense that it is very highly integrated with the German business cycle, as I understand. The hard currency is independent of the euro, but they keep it very closely aligned with the Deutschmark, because it is their biggest closest neighbour. And so the kind of the context of this small open economy networks is very distinctive, and that all that has to be taken seriously. And then my third point is about the mobilisation of interest. And I find these things about solidarity very interesting in that context, because, you know, we've heard the reflections on nationalism. We've heard the comments on the weight of US, the American sector in the Irish economy, and the dissemination of American organisation models in Ireland. So the ways in which solidarity, social solidarity, is conceptualised are going to be conditioned not just by ideas of nationalism, but by, again, these material contexts. And the way in which class interests and issues can be articulated is going to be very different. It's one of those things that's long bemoaned by the Irish left. You know, why can't we have an ordinary, as it were, left-right divide in Ireland? And it's certainly been a real, you know, bane of the articulation of inequality issues, and to really express issues about distributive outcomes, that it's very hard to do in those terms. But the other side of it is that solidarity is generated through this very peculiar sort of cross-class coalition within Fine Gael itself, and sort of perforce through the enforced coalition of Fine Gael and Labour as the only alternative viable coalitional governmental force in Ireland. To date, it's all unravelling at the moment. We don't know where it'll all go. But it has generated very different capabilities for cooperation and networking that are very distinctive. So it's the distinctiveness that, as much as the commonalities that, or the pattern seeking, that stand out for me. And my final point on this is about, again, the virtue of looking not just synchronically but diachronically. You know, we can mark similarities at any moment of time. We can mark differences at any one moment in time. Ireland still looks very like a liberal market economy. Denmark still looks very like a social democratic economy. But as Sean has been reminding us, you know, Thalen's story about varieties of liberalisation is an international phenomenon. And Wolfgang Streich, our man who gave the IOR presentation, the PhD student, Felix, I'm so sorry. Fritz Sharp is something you just displaced your name, I'm so sorry. Wolfgang Streich, story about how Germany became something that is still kind of, you know, in lots of ways, a commodity market economy. Actually, it's not, because we live in this world now of the penetration of markets, the flexibilization of everything, the world of global markets and national politics. So this ungoverned economic space is kind of soaking into everything and displacing everything, even as we speak. So the casualization work and all that is something that is that is ongoing. It's these are trends we need to be watching. I'm sorry, I've spoken too long. Thank you.
Oh, thanks very much indeed, Nate. Thank you.